In just a few verses, Jesus powerfully and directly upheld the sanctity of the Sabbath and the law that defines it. He taught things about the Sabbath that have always been true, that have always often been put aside by the religious leaders of that time and even into our time. Today, on this Sabbath in Tacoma, almost 2,000 years later, let's consider some of the lessons that Jesus taught that Sabbath in the grain fields. And I'm going to keep saying that phrase because I want us to think about it. Something so important happened then that really has been almost overlooked, even by those who I've been blessed to have been taught by over the years. There are six main elements of how Jesus dealt with on that dangerous and volatile situation. The example and the teachings of Jesus that Sabbath in the grain field still guides us in our understanding and practice of obeying the fourth commandment of God, that is to remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. Again, you've got the title, that Sabbath in the grain fields. So first, let me read through the account in Matthew in chapter 12, verse 1 through 8. If we read this in context from beginning to end, it will help us to have an entire account in mind as we begin the body of the message today. And then we can go back and look at those verses and pick up some very, very interesting points. What Jesus was talking about, the things that he mentioned, are interconnected and progressively moving to some of the most important truths about the Sabbath in all of the scriptures in this short passage. Mark and Luke add some details. You can see those on the handout I gave you, or turn and read them there. And we'll cover some of those as we consider the details of this very, very amazing account. So in Matthew chapter 12, verse 1 through 6. I'll just read through this. We'll come back and analyze it. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." Notice that most of these verses in red are in red in the handout, and these are the words of Jesus Christ himself. And it's in those words, in those few verses right there, that we can see six important lessons about the Sabbath day that are still so very, very important and valid for you and for me. This gives us a context and a perspective that will help us to gain more as we take a closer look then through all of these things. Let's consider this and the passages in Mark and Luke a little more closely. And brethren, I'm going to stay as close as I can today to the subject matter as possible as presented here in these scriptures. I say this because when I started this message, I was starting it from a different point of view. 3-4 weeks ago when I started looking, I was saying, "I've heard this, but they say this, but." And I was trying then to refute heresy. I don't want to go there today. I want to focus on what Jesus Christ taught that Sabbath in the grain fields and see what we can see from his own words. In Matthew 12, verse 1, "At that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, began to pluck the heads of grain and to eat." They went through, it was on like footpaths through these grain fields that were there. Back in that time, the grain fields were scattered in between the villages and the dwellings and the farms. And instead of big roads like we have today, they had footpaths that would take them through. And Luke chapter 6 and verse 1, and for these references, you can see, just read across the page, you see those same verses there, so you don't even have to turn. By the way, if you're at home and listening and you want a handout, just send me an email and I can reply and send it back to you. Please make it by email, not by text, because I don't know how to reply back by text with a copy, unless someone wants to show me. But Luke provides a couple of additional details. Luke says, "Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields." This is the only time marker that we see in this passage. It's a time marker that scholars consider as pointing to the time right after the Feast of Unleavened Bread that we see in John chapter 5, when Jesus and his disciples were in Jerusalem. And something very significant happened there on a Sabbath day as well. And we'll give that some thought just as in a few minutes. But I wanted to point this out. This time marker will come back into play later as we look at the rest of the things that Jesus said. We'll pick it up just a little bit later. "And his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands." And so Luke adds this, "rubbing them in their hands." By the way, if you have the handout, and you can see there in Luke 6:1, there is a misspelling, and I corrected it on every page that we handed out. I did a spell check on my computer. I got it all done, got it off, spell check, checked everything, got 100% rating, printed out 60 copies, and then I read one of the copies, and I go, "What? This word, icked." I'm going to read it here just for, take a little moment, a little humor. In Luke 6:1, at the top of my handout, says, "And his disciples icked," I-C-K-E-D, "they icked the heads of grain." No, they plucked them. Maybe they wish they had something better than the raw grain, but they're going, "ick." But they plucked those heads. So just a little point, but sometimes we struggle with the things that we're preparing. But then, by Luke's account, look in verse 2, "And some of the Pharisees said to them," this word "said" is important, and you can see the emphasis of this later, "they were criticizing. They said to them," notice this, "they said to the disciples," they were saying, "What? Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" This was a direct thing to the disciples. "Why are you picking that grain?" What happens then? If we put these accounts together, we can see something so beautiful, so awesome, and it helps us to understand who Jesus Christ is. It appears that they first accused the disciples, and then they turned their accusation to Jesus, speaking directly to him back in Matthew 12, in verse 2. "But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him," so you see this flow, first to the disciples and then to Christ. "They said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.'" And in Mark's account, there's a different word. Mark uses the word to describe what the Pharisees said as they spoke to Jesus. In Mark 1 and verse 24, "They said to him," and the Greek word for this word in Mark's account is elegon, E-L-E-G-O-N, and it means they kept on speaking. They didn't just mention it. They didn't just say calmly, "Why are your disciples doing that?" They kept on. This was not a quiet conversation. They kept on speaking to him about the matter. Their understanding of the law was, according to the rabbinic statutes and their written and oral traditions that they lived by, which were very important to them and which they held to very, very tightly, which they considered as binding on all the Jewish people, from which they judged that at least two sins had been committed. That is the plucking of the grain, it's harvesting, which was reaping or harvesting, and then rubbing them in their hands, which was sifting or even grinding. The offense that the Pharisees claimed seems to also include the preparation of food on the Sabbath. But at least those two, those were sins that they thought these disciples had committed. And they were vigorously and vociferously talking about this, arguing with Christ and with his disciples. So Christ then defends his disciples. They were accused of doing what the Pharisees believed was not lawful. This was a very harsh accusation against the legality of Sabbath keeping. I want to emphasize this and point to what they would have known right away, would have been in their minds as they did this and said this. It's an accusation that was so intense that the punishment for any offender was to be killed. Already, probably just a couple weeks earlier, we could see this from that time marker that I mentioned in Luke, the second Sabbath after the first. Already, when Jesus and his disciples were in Jerusalem, the Jews had sought to kill Jesus for what they considered to be breaking the Sabbath. Jesus had healed a man at the pool of Bethesda. He'd been lame for, I think, 38 years. He healed him on that Sabbath day. And I'm going to turn then to John chapter 5, and you see this. You can read this whole passage here in John chapter 5. We're going to focus on verse 16 and 17. For this reason, this after the man is healed on the Sabbath day, for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. So now we're seeing some really strong connection here to the Sabbath, what happened just a week or two before, and then now in this grain field. But Jesus answered them, verse 17, please mark this. This is such an important point to the message. My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. The man was healed on the Sabbath day. Christ was there and performed that miracle. And what did he say? My Father has been working. This man was healed because my Father is working on the Sabbath. We could paraphrase it. I was working on the Sabbath by healing this man, working in the sense that they considered work. It's very interesting. They sought to kill him for that. Let's continue. Mark recorded the account with a different word describing how the Pharisees spoke to Jesus. And we saw that already in Mark chapter 1. They kept on speaking. That was something that so serious, they just wouldn't let it go. And Jesus begins to open up about some things then that lead us to the points that we can learn. They sought to kill him because they thought he had broken the Sabbath, but also because he said he made himself equal with God. Look in John chapter 5 and verse 18. Therefore, the Jews sought the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, as they thought, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. These are two main things that tracked through the ministry of Jesus Christ all the way to his crucifixion. These things about the Sabbath and claiming to be the Son of God. Very, very important things to notice here. These things had come up in that grain field on the Sabbath day. And so, point one is this. In Matthew 12, verse 3 and 4, where he begins to say, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priest. I want to make a little sidebar here, but it's an important sidebar. The Pharisees had begun talking first to his disciples, and then they turned their attention to Jesus, and now Jesus answers them. What is he doing? He stepped in to protect his disciples. The shepherd protecting his flock, because he knew how serious that was. He knew where this would lead if he didn't take hold of this situation. And he stepped in between those Pharisees and his disciples. Now, these were different Pharisees than the ones in Jerusalem. These were ones in a different area out in Galilee. But wherever he went, he encountered these things. And I believe on purpose. I believe he wanted to instruct his disciples, but also the Pharisees and the Jewish people, that things were different than they had thought. But he stepped in. You can almost envision this where he literally, I think, would move between them and with his voice, commanding the situation and raising this and not arguing with them, not back and forth like he did on some occasions. In this one, it's his words, straightforward, no argument coming back. What he said was so profound. He said, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?" See, Christ went directly back to the written word of God, not to his opinion of it, not to the refuting something that they were claiming. He went to the written word of God. In Luke 6 and verse 3, we see this as well. "But Jesus answering them said, 'Have you not even read this?'" Put some emphasis and emotion with what he's saying to these people. "Haven't you even read this?" Mark also emphasizes it. "Have you never read?" He's talking to Pharisees who would have been students of the law, students of the scriptures, would have known these. And he's just saying to them, "You're saying these things, but what about what's in the written word of God?" You could paraphrase it this way. Some of the books I looked at did. "Have you not so much as read this?" Have you not even read this? He put it on them like, man, you should know these things. You should know them. So point one is this. Jesus refers to God's written word in the prophets and the law because he spoke of both things, the example of David and what was written in the law that described that. He turns to the Holy Scriptures. So this is the first of these six ways that Jesus, he defended the conduct of his disciples, and at the same time, he upheld the sanctity of the Sabbath. He went straight to the scriptures, not even debating the traditions. Who could win an argument with one of them anyway? He never did. He was always right, but they were always coming back with something. It's one of my sayings, and he used this word later in his ministry to describe the Pharisees as hypocrites. One of my sayings is you can never win an argument with a hypocrite. So he didn't even try. He just pointed it out and let them deal with it. First, in the prophets, that is historical account of David and the showbread. And we should read this. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1 through 6. And I want to turn there because Jesus brought this example up. I'm making myself in this message stick only with what he brought up. 1 Samuel 21, and verse 1 through 6. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" So David said to Ahimelech the priest, David said something that wasn't really true. He said this, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business of which I send you or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found.' And the priest answered David and said, 'There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women, there were ceremonial points of purity and cleanliness that were important to eat to the priest, and he mentioned that. And David comes back. David answered the priest and said, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out.'" A lot of discussion could go there, but let's just follow through. "And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day." Christ is referring to this incident. It says, "So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord." Notice this next phrase. "In order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away." He's mentioning here in the historical context this event with David, but he refers back to the law, as we see also in Samuel. There's something to look at. In the UCG Bible commentary on 1 Samuel 21, we can read this. I just quote it for you here. And this quote comes from there, but also within that, the Nelson Study Bible. And it says, "Jesus referred to this incident in Matthew 12 and Mark 2 in his discussion with the Pharisees concerning the Sabbath. The spirit of the law was kept by Ahimelech's compassionate act. That much is true, for Christ upheld the feeding of David with the bread." Christ upheld this. And David was able then to eat of that bread and those who were with him. Notice some things here, brethren. There's some similarities between what's happening in these two events, in the grain field and there in Nob at the tabernacle with David and his men and the showbread. David went into the house of God, not just walking in the grain fields. David, the shepherd of Israel, was accompanied by his followers. So was Christ there in that grain field. In Mark 2, verse 25, we see that Jesus pointed out that David and his men were in need. That's a generic term, and they were hungry. Specific description, the particular character of their need. They were in need, and they were hungry. And so they went to the house of God. Likewise, that Sabbath in the grain fields, the disciples of Jesus were in need. They were hungry. There's a sidebar with a lesson. There's more. I want to continue on this. I'm going to take some time with this point because it develops the text and the context well enough to see what follows better. A sidebar with a lesson. Notice something different here compared to what Jesus mentioned in Mark's account. Look in your handout. You can see there in Mark's account, in verse 26, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest. 1 Samuel says Ahimelech. Why is Christ referring to Abiathar here? There's something important, and the Pharisees in that field would have known this. It's helpful if we see it too. the rest of that story. And I'll just briefly cover this. You could look and read through some of the context of 1 Samuel. You see in chapter 20 on to about 23, 24, the rest of that story. A servant of Saul was also there that day, a man named Doeg. Doeg told Saul, who then had Ahimelech and all his father's house and the priests who were in Nob brought in for questioning. He condemned them to death and ordered the guards to kill them all, the priests of God and all the men who were there. The servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. So Saul told Doeg to kill them, and he did. In the New King James Version, it says there were 85 men that Doeg killed who served in the Lord's house. 85. In the Septuagint Version, which is quoted often in the New Testament by Christ and the apostles, 305 is the number that is given there that were killed because of what David did. 85 to 305, a lot of men. To serve in the temple and the tabernacle, a man had to be at least 20 and up to 58 years of age. So these were probably husbands and fathers. We're talking about a lot of destruction in the nation of Israel at the time. And they didn't stop there. Also, many residents of the city, men and women, children and nursing infants, and even the animals. So this was a big thing. Saul had Doeg and probably some helpers go and kill everybody who lived in that town, according to the scriptures, except one of Ahimelech's son, Abiathar, escaped, made his way to David. And you can read this in 1 Samuel 22, verse 21 through 23. I'll read it for you. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. So David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me. Do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. What an event this was. A man goes into the house of God and asks for bread, and this is the result that comes from it. You see how serious some of these things can be sometimes. Jesus was correct in mentioning Abiathar, and the Pharisees would have known this. They would have put this story together. All of this was part of their own study in history. Continuing with point one. This is the long one, and the others won't be nearly so long. Jesus also referred to God's written word in the law. According to the law, the showbread was meant only for the priests, yet David and his men ate of it. Let's see what this is about. What does the law say about the showbread that ties in with what Jesus said that Sabbath in the grain fields? In all three accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus referenced God's written word in the law. He mentioned the house of God, the showbread, and the law relating to who may eat it. We can see this in Leviticus chapter 24. And I'm just going to paraphrase some of these, but you can look and see these things if you'd like. Leviticus 24, verse 5. Where it says, and you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. These were the cakes of the showbread. Verse 8 and 9, every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place. For it is most holy to him from the offering of the Lord made by fire by perpetual statute. This was a Sabbath matter, something that happened every Sabbath, first in the tabernacle, later in the temple. This was a brilliant defense of the Sabbath. Jesus used the perfect example to teach this truth. He did not argue with them, but simply referenced the words of God. A little bit of a tangent. I was struggling with preparing this message. I kept wanting to go in different directions, and I kept trying to just stick right here with what we see. Last Sabbath here, where we're gathered today, before services, a family drove up in the parking lot, and I watched them come in. Others in the lobby saw them too. A grandmother comes out of the car and comes to our door and comes in. And she begins to ask for help. She begins to say that they're going to be evicted from the hotel room where they were, and they would be out on the street. She was the grandmother, apparently the mother driving, and she said there were four children in the car. I saw one young boy, and maybe there were other children sleeping in the back seat. She came and she asked for help. She had need. She came to the house of God, where we are. Not quite the temple or the tabernacle, but where we gather. And she asked for a specific amount of help. David asked for 5 loaves. She asked for $40. Not much, but it was specific. And I told her, our pastor's not here yet. He'll be here soon, and he makes those decisions for us. And she said, I can't wait. We have this time period. We're going to be evicted at 12:30 if I don't get back. I don't know if she's telling the truth. David didn't tell the truth when he went to the priest. The king didn't send him. So that wasn't the question at all, whether she's telling the truth. The point is this. She came here to ask for help. I think God was helping me to feel this message and not just to learn it. I didn't put all this together till afterwards. I said, give me a moment. I went, looked in my wallet. Nancy knows how much is there. She gives me my allowance every 2 weeks. I found the $20 bill that she stuck in there. The lady was asking for 40. Nancy came over and gave me 20 more. And we gave it to her. And she left. And I stepped out. And the young boy was looking toward the building. And as they drove, I waved. They waved back. Just did a little prayer. The grandmother did the little prayer. That little boy saw this. I don't know in the years to come how God will call that little boy, but something like this might make a difference for him. When our pastor came, the new guy, I told him about this. And he said, and so you gave her the showbread. Well, it got the point. I hadn't put it together until he said that. And then he agreed that it could be from the congregation and not just from me and Nancy. So you extended mercy to someone in need who came to the house of God. What a great blessing. These things can tie in ways that sometimes we don't even get until later. I know I'm going to go over time, so I'll just tell you up front. Point two, in Matthew's account, we see the second way that Jesus upheld the Sabbath. He refers again to the Holy Scriptures, the instructions given to the priests on how they were to help God's people worship on the Sabbath day. Matthew 12, verse 5 says, "Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath day the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" He spoke of what was going on that very day in the temple in Jerusalem. There was work going on by God's command, defined in his written word in the law. You can look in Numbers, and I'll just reference these Numbers 3, verse 5 through 8. And I'll read it, but you can write it down, look it up. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall attend to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting, to do the work of the tabernacle. In the law of Moses, it was called the work of the tabernacle. Verse 8 says, and they shall attend to all the furnishings of the tabernacle of meeting and to the need of the children of Israel. Again, to do the work of the tabernacle. And so from the beginning, when the tabernacle was established, the time of Moses, there was work to be done. It was ordained by God that it be done, and it was called work, labor. Leviticus 1 is quite an interesting chapter. It talks about and describes some of that work that was to be done. And I've just paraphrased it down this way. You can read Leviticus 1 and see here instructions to the priests concerning the burnt offerings. It's pretty descriptive, and it tells you what was happening. Every Sabbath day, from the time the tabernacle was consecrated to the time of Christ and his disciples until that building was demolished, it gets pretty descriptive. They were to kill it. All the sacrifices, bring the blood before the Lord, sprinkle it on and around the altar, skin the animal. How many of you have ever skinned a large animal? Probably some of you. Cut it into pieces, put fire on the altar, and lay the wood in order on the fire. And then they lay the parts of the animal on the fire, wash the entrails and legs with water, and more. It was a lot of work. This was the worship in the tabernacle, and Christ is referencing this to those Pharisees that day. In addition to the work of removing the old showbread and replacing it with new hot bread, each Sabbath was required of the priest. Hot bread was placed, the old bread was taken off. Who commanded the priest to do this? The Lord. Who is the Lord? We heard in the first message, Jesus Christ. He determines what works are not a violation of the Sabbath. And that Sabbath in the grain fields, he referenced the laws of the priesthood in the scriptures. Why? Why did he do that? Jesus was reminding them that there is some labor, some real work upon the Sabbath as not a violation of its sacredness. The work of the priest in the tabernacle was to help people worship God, including with sacrifices, and those sacrifices foreshadowed the sacrifice of the Messiah, and thus they came to receive his mercy. They wanted their God to be merciful for them. They brought sacrifices, and God extended his mercy to them. The forgiveness of sins and provision of all their needs. He brings this point out very clearly a couple verses later. This is part of how Christ was defending his disciples and upholding the Sabbath day. Besides the priest, who else does Scripture reveal as working on the Sabbath day? Who else? We just read a little while ago in John chapter 5, verse 16 through 18. I quote, for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. What work was done on the Sabbath when Jesus said that? The man at the pool was healed. When you are healed, you are experiencing God working in your body, in your life, and Jesus Christ as well. This is an act of mercy extended to us. God is working on the Sabbath day often when people are healed. Last summer, we had an event here, and one of you is here again today. One of the ladies began to have a very serious episode of not being able to breathe very well. And she made it known to us. And she was anointed. We called the EMTs to come because from her history, we knew that she very likely would need some medical care. But we had prayed for her back here at the back of this room. Mr. Porteous was there to help me anoint her. We moved her out to the front of the building so the EMTs could have easy access to her. And they came, and they checked her over, and they took her blood, or to put her oxygen level. In 15 minutes after she could hardly breathe, her oxygen level was back to 100%. 100. Every time I've had mine checked, I've only been in the 95 to 98 range. Never 100. 100. God worked here on that Sabbath day, healing one of us. God works on the Sabbath. And Christ is pointing this out. In his capacity as the Son of God, Jesus is in many spiritual ways equal with God, and he certainly has the right and authority to do acts of mercy on the Sabbath. He was methodically and powerfully building toward that point, and we'll see this in just a bit. Point three, he speaks of prophecy. This is in Matthew 12, verse 6. But I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. Think of this. To hear those words, you're standing in that grain field. There's one here greater than the temple. He just keeps elevating the lesson for those who are present that Sabbath day. In 2 Chronicles, you can read in chapter 6, 2 Chronicles 6, verse 18, where Solomon was dedicating the temple, that best and most expensive and most elaborate of all the temples ever built. But will God indeed dwell with men on the earth? Behold, the heaven and the heavens of heaven cannot contain you. How much less this temple which I have built? Brethren, there are many other verses that speak of this. In Isaiah, in Malachi, and in Hebrews 3, it says this, he who built the house has more honor than the house. One greater than the temple was there. Christ is talking in that grain field to people who are saying, but they're plucking grain, and Christ is saying, there's one greater than the temple is here. Point four, Jesus quoted scripture again to teach of God's purpose on the Sabbath. This is Matthew 12 and verse 7. But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would have not condemned the guiltless. You see how he upheld the conduct of his disciples? The guiltless. They were not guilty. They had not broken the Sabbath. This is a direct quote from Hosea chapter 6 and verse 6, where he says, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. There's always something far more acceptable to God than sacrifice, and that was acts of mercy. Just a few verses later in Matthew 12, you can see this. I'm going to turn and read this because it's so powerful. It happened, I believe, on that same Sabbath day in Matthew 12. Here in verse 12. Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. Christ is saying directly, it is lawful, it's not against his law, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. This was right after he had healed the man with the withered hand. You know, he didn't do that by doing physical work. He spoke the word. And the man simply extended his hand. He didn't lift anything. There was no breaking of the law there. in the way that Christ looks at it, they were condemning the guiltless. God desires mercy. The Lord was merciful to David and his men on that Sabbath day, even though David lied. He had come to the house of God and he had need, and God gave him the bread. God extended that mercy. Sometimes we come to God and we're not perfect either, but we have need and he's merciful to us. Ahimelech was a merciful high priest. He made a decision to help with what was available. Christ is our merciful high priest. You know, he performed many miraculous acts of mercy on the Sabbath days, purposely setting the example that's lawful to do acts of mercy on the Sabbath day. And condemning the guiltless was not merciful. Point five, Jesus shows the Sabbath was made for man. It wasn't made because man should worship the Sabbath. It was made for the benefit of man. And he said to them, Mark 2, verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. He made the Sabbath for the sake of, for the benefit of man. And that word is anthropos. It means the entire race of the human race for mankind. He made it before Adam and Eve had sinned. He made it when there was that one Sabbath, at least, when there was a beautiful arrangement where God could speak and dwell and be with Adam and Eve as they went through their first day of life. He made it for man, for all of the descendants of Adam and Eve. It's a sign between God and those of his covenant. And we look and say, who made the Sabbath? Remember in the first message, and we read John chapter 1 and verse 3. Really appreciated that. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. The principle that one greater than the temple who was there made the Sabbath day. It says, therefore, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. It wasn't meant to be a burden. It was part of Christ's mission to restore the Sabbath for his disciples, for his church to its original intent and meaning. Point six, Jesus asserts his lordship over the Sabbath as the Son of Man, the Creator, the Messiah. Matthew 12 and verse 8, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. He's Lord. This word kurios for Lord means he to whom a person or thing belongs. The Sabbath belongs to Jesus Christ the Lord. He is the Lord, the owner, the possessor, the protector. Mark adds an interesting word. He's the only one of the three that has this word. Therefore, the Son of Man is, the word in the New King James is also Lord of the Sabbath. And I looked this up in the Greek and English lexicon just to be sure. And the word here is a Greek word kai, K-A-I, and it's translated even. The Son of Man is Lord also, or even, of the Sabbath. It emphasizes and it points to his lordship of the Sabbath as inviolable. So this is an older word used back in the 18th, 19th century, more than now, inviolable. So I looked up synonyms for this. It means sacred. He's also Lord of the Sabbath. This is something that is a sacred position that he owns. It's an unchangeable thing. It's unchallengeable. It's sacrosanct. It's absolute, secure. It's holy. It's unassailable. Jesus Christ is Lord of the Sabbath. No one else is or ever will be. The Son of Man is the word. Notice what in John, they were ready to kill Christ because he said, He was the God was his father, making himself equal with God. In this short passage, he's saying, one greater than the temple, the Son of Man. He's telling it straight out to these people who were there. The Son of Man is the Word who was with God in the beginning and who was God, who is now manifest in human flesh, born of a woman, made like his brethren, yet God with us, Jesus Christ. He was greater than the temple. Among all his divine honors, Jesus is also Lord of the Sabbath. He decides how the Sabbath should be kept holy. No one else. He does. We worship him, receiving his mercy and extending mercy to others. So, brethren, I came down to those 6 points. And this morning, I'm laying in bed, like 4 a.m. Has this ever happened to you, these other speakers? And I'm going, okay, so I got this. I learned so much doing this. But then there was one more thing that came to mind, and I'm going, God, you, thank you. You put it all in perspective for me. You make it so now it's something I can not only believe, but it really touches me so very closely. You think back of what we just read. What was the miracle that happened that day? That day in the grain field, that Sabbath. What was the miracle that happened? He didn't heal anybody. He talked. He spoke. Who was there in the field with him? The Pharisees and his disciples. And he defended them. He stood between them, I think. He protected them. He speaks so well and eloquently of the Sabbath. He elevates it to this highest level. In doing that, he's performing a miracle. In John 1, in verse 10 and 12, we see he was not trying to convince the Pharisees. In John 1, verse 10 and 12, he was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. And he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. We've just seen the evidence of that in that Sabbath in the grain field. Those people who just didn't receive him. Or was he doing something so much more important? Who else was there? The disciples. Verse 12, John 1, verse 12. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. His disciples heard these words. They heard him say, one greater than the temple, the Son of God. They heard him say, their teacher is the Lord of the Sabbath. You imagine being there as a disciple and you're hearing those words come from his mouth. I am the Lord of the Sabbath. Powerful words. That day when they were hungry, he was merciful to them. They heard the voice of their shepherd. They saw him as he said that they should. They were with the merciful high priest in a place greater than the temple. What happened that Sabbath in the grain fields was a very powerful miracle. God the Father and Jesus Christ his Son were both working that Sabbath day. We've just read of their work, changing the hearts of the disciples. And that miraculous work is still happening today on this Sabbath. here. In John 20, we'll close with this. In John 20 and verse 30, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." What a powerful miracle that's still going on. It's a spiritual thing that's happening in our lives. And Jesus Christ taught that most important aspect of the Sabbath day, of who is the Lord and how it shall be kept. What a blessing it is that we can have his words to teach us. Brethren, have a happy Sabbath.